is exactly on trying to find those good examples, because so far we haven't been involved in any. That all we've seen is the gap. Like when we see that there is a problem, that it's too late, right? And it seems that the problem is that what we really have to do is to bring those people to the table before, right? So I think those examples that were there was exactly on creating the timing, right? So you don't wait until you have your results and then you come here, use it, it's awesome. Instead, you bring everybody to the table and discuss. Right. So that's what we're doing now. I mean, I hope that we will be able to have success on that. I do have two examples that were mentioned to me as effective on that way. So Camp Child, which is where my postdoc is now, it started, I don't know if you're familiar with Camp Child, but the way they started was actually bringing the Ministry of Children and Youth, Family and Children, Ontario Ministry of Children and Youth, to the table to say, look, we have this bunch of researchers doing child disability research, and we need money to translate this research to the public. And for several years until there was a budget cut, but they were funded by the ministry, and they would have regular meetings with them to discuss, okay, which are the priorities? So the government has this agenda, which is not depending on your research for sure, but how can you address this agenda and respond quickly enough with this information? So that has been successful in a sense. BC also has, I think, a great example, especially for the autism group, on having what they call a shared research agenda, and it's an official event. So they have monthly meetings between key researchers and the Ministry of Children, Youth, Families, and Social Services, I think. So they come together and do exactly the same. So this is our agenda, this is our agenda. Let's compare and cross how we can inform each other better. So I think those are the models that are likely to succeed, and there are several projects that have been derived from those, and that's what we're trying to do here with some of these examples. But,
so the idea, in other words, is to have policy and research communicated at an earlier level in a way.
Exactly.
And more constant throughout the...
Exactly, not, you know, sporadic or communications, yeah. Because then you cut on the translation need, right? You were generating knowledge together.
Right.
So there is less of a need to translate anything at the end because you've done this together.
I have a good question. You mentioned socioeconomic variables. Sorry, I'm having a hard time today. My question is, what is the impact of the family's socioeconomic level on access for children? Did you look at that?
Yeah, so we looked at that in two different ways. For leisure, it was an important determinant. So for children in families of lower, by two measurements, so family, total family income, and parental education level. So kids with lower income, lower parental level, mother and father education, different combinations, did participate less, especially in physical activities. Why? I mean, we don't have that answer, but I think because, you know, physical activities are the ones that for children with disabilities require equipment, require transportation. We, you know, think of their favorite snow sports. Like it's not cheap, it's not easy, it's not close. So that's, for in leisure for sure, it is a factor. And that has been shown in other studies as well, in other populations. So in case of preterm, recently a colleague finished a PhD on, and it was the same. In Ontario, like the same. So across the board, kids with lower level income participate less. And that's why we want to look at now at this what is available in terms of public resources. So comparing OPSQ programs with family income and social deprivation index through the CP registry to see, okay, how those are the regions that have a lower social deprivation or higher social deprivation index also have less programs, and how does that impact participation? What can we do about that? So now for access, in terms of general access, because another measure, we didn't see a difference across family income, but probably not. I think what the problem was more the questionnaire than the construct itself. So that's why we want to just do a real population-based data. Not that this is not real, but with larger samples to see, in real indicators, which seems to be a problem as well, right? So the indicators that we measure on research are often not indicators that policy uses to do anything about it. So That's why we want to use their language to try to put into.
Can I have a follow-up question on that, just a really quick one? Did you find that for the lowest socioeconomic deprivation, there was sometimes more programs being targeted at that specific population? I'm thinking, I live in this neighborhood that's now becoming quite mixed, but Pointe Saint-Charles was historically a lower socioeconomic neighborhood, and they have a lot of programs geared at disability. And I'm wondering if I compare that neighborhood with a middle-income neighborhood, there might be more programs in my neighborhood than in a middle-income neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering, did you have a chance to look at that?
We will look at that. That's what we're hoping to look at with this new project. We'll look exactly at programs offered by government and social integration. And we haven't looked at this before.
There's something about the language, you say you're adapting your language. Are you finding that for the policymakers, that using it from a rights angle or using it from leisure or disability, like it's something, or does it depend on who you're talking to? Is there some language that's proving more convincing or?
Right, yeah, it seems that I don't think there's a difference to the type of language in general. I mean, the problem here is really the message, more so, and adapt your message to the person receiving the message. It's like pretty, you know, common sense, but it's interesting because it's not, let's say, policy briefs, let's say, which is like a classic communication output. If it's not adapted to, you know, this specific ministry or to this specific department, it usually doesn't go too far. So that's, I think the thing is more on adapting the content to the need than the language. I mean, the language is, I think it's an entity, it has to be like simple, it has to be short, it can be lengthy, it can be data-ish, right? It has to be something that's practical and applicable. But what I'm saying it's more important is really being able to adapt. So people, it's the one example in Australia, for instance, they've hired, I don't know here how, I've talked to different researchers who have done that or have heard of that, but they hired a lobbyist, for instance, and as part of the research group. And this lobbyist, the solution was to target the messages, right? So that's not something we are used to do. So, and it seems like it's even, is it the right thing to do? But, and they had a huge impact. They created, they changed the whole disability programs in Australia, like this research group based on this strategy. I mean, not a lobbyist, it was one of the things, but they were addressing, so both sides, right, they're listening what the policymakers were saying they needed, and they were fitting into the population data, they were just making this connection. So I think it's more important adapting the message to the target audience.
When you say adapt, I think the issue, in a way, maybe the adapting, I think that might be what Gabby meant, right? Adapting the message means that, for example, some interlocutors will be more sensitive to the language of rights to say,
exactly, oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Others would be, but it's what they need, right? Again, it's, you know, you need to know what they need, and
right.
You need to know your enemies, you need to know who are you talking to, right? So, because that is the direct impact on the ability to hear.
A policymaker recently told me that basically, you use the language from the budget, the speech was known, and that's what, I mean, that's what they have to, that's what the government has to actually deliver on. So
right.
You can feed back, you can get yours with something that's a priority from the budget, the speech was known.
Exactly. Then, exactly, yeah. So it goes good. And again, having, attaching what you're saying, like, in terms of budget, you know, like, attaching anything to a money figure, it seems key, and it's not something that we used to do also. But I've heard that like over and over in interviews, it's like what's the value of this, of promoting the trip? What is the economic cost? What is the economic benefit? What is the output? So for decisions at the higher level, it's not about kids being, nothing, but you know, it's the quality of life. Yes, it's important, everybody, nobody would deny that it's important, but if you can't attach that to a money figure, then it's hard to negotiate, right? Hard to go up in the scale, yeah.
Ten? You got your hand up?
No.
Oh.
That was my last one.
Oh, okay.
My question. Yeah.
I'm so glad. Sorry.
Glad to know I'm on.
I have a clarification question. Did you say that the facial activity is considered part of the leisure from their point of view? The shop activity, like have a shop.
It's
part of the leisure for.
Right. In this questionnaire, yes, it was considered because the definition for leisure and varies, but in this specific measure that we use, it is because it's considered anything that's out of school. So activities that are out of school are considered leisure. So their paid job is the one. And I mean, for the lesson especially, you know, it may be considered leisure or something that you do for choice.
And is there any program in order to include them in this job market?
There are different programs, let's say, majority of them based on the rehab center, so transition programs. And those are being now more and more being created. It's new. I can't tell you precise like numbers, but I know there's part of the training students that are part of transition programs in rehab centers, so for older kids. But that would be something to look at in terms of government-based programs, what is offered for integrating the job market at different levels. There are quota systems and things like that can be considered. But it's not part of the normal flow of activities, but it's been now introduced in transition programs.
In general, you find that one of the things that I was looking at is, you list the leisure activities. If you think about kids who aren't kids with disabilities, there are definitely some that we want to encourage, mm-hmm. and others that we want to discourage, right?
Right.
So, we have tax credits for people to get involved their kids in sports. As far as I know, there isn't a jurisdiction in Canada that gets tax credits for video games, right?
Right.
So there's kind of a perfectionist kind of slant to the way we. Think about the leisure activities of kids without disabilities. To have to do things that are involve more skill, more physical activity. And is there a sense when you're dealing with kids especially with motor difficulties, that as long as we can get them to do something that they like, that's fine. Mm-hmm. We're not going to try to gear them towards something that in the way we would with kids without disabilities.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's the trend, right? That's what happened. Like whatever you can do that you're able to do, just go and do it. And that's the problem, right? Because there are a lot of initiatives, let's say, to promote physical active, and there's a reason for that, right? It's not just because we think it's right, it's because it promotes health and cardiovascular and long term outcomes and whatnot. So, but those activities and even the big campaigns and health public promotion campaigns do not address the needs of kids with disabilities in that. So it's just that it's you do what you can and good luck. So that's where I think the shift needs to be on, okay, so how do we include children in the mainstream of children, or in the activities that all children should be doing.
Or that have adaptive versions for, I don't know, the picture of a quite a complicated sort of ski apparatus.
Yeah, there are many different programs, adaptive programs, but usually they are costly, they are not highly accessible for everybody, but they do exist. It's a matter of, how do we integrate them into more highly accessible programs, and if you take the fitness credit, it's like I think it's $75 that you get for and then plus 50 if you have a disability. So
you can submit for up to $500.
That's
but
right.
I don't know what you get for that.
But you only get a very low portion back. I think it's $75 and plus the 50. So it's like. It just doesn't pay anything, right? It will pay one session of skiing. So, it's a matter of, again, can you finance every single activity? That's not the point. The discussion is, okay, how can we make it more accessible, or what do we need to make more accessible, right? So.
Question about education and schools, but is there a big disconnect between where the decisions are made and where they're implemented, or I know it's going to be different for every program, but I would suspect that a lot of these are school-based or integrated with schools somehow,
right.
And yet decisions being made, it sounds like, when you're talking at different groups. Can you talk about that at all?
Actually a very interesting point, because what we've seen is that, let's say the research, where research happens is one sphere, where policy happens in one, and other things happen in another one. And for leisure specifically, it is true that a lot of things are happening in the school, and this has been now, so that's a part of like only you think what we've been thinking. So things that happen in school tends to be easier, right? Because kids are already there, it's mandatory, kids will have to be there anyway, so we might as well complement and have programs happening there. But the thing is that the majority of both research and policy happens at the health level, right? And the integration with health and education, which seems, should be more integrated, it's not. So that's a part of the problem that we're thinking, okay, if we go to the school system, right, if we talk education and promotion at that level, then how can you justify that with the health? Or, I mean, it seems logic, but all those, this is another layer that for sure is not happening. And for kids, again, if you look at the special schools, segregated schools versus regular schools, it's a discussion that is already there, right? So integration is not, it's not mandatory, it's not the mainstream here, let's say, in Quebec and Canada most. But anyways, it's so, should we emphasize, where do we go with programs? Do we attend the kids that are more severe, who are in segregated schools? Or should we mainstream and emphasize the kids who are in regular schools? Or should we just make it the community, which then is another jurisdiction, right? So those are for sure added layers of complication.
I guess as a follow-up, with the work doing research at that level,
yeah,
you sort of shift your focus.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what we, like, part of this, of the CP Square and only like in other programs, is to integrate into the school. And then having school and rehab and, you know, health and then also talk together again. It's bringing more people to the table. But it's not a, you know, it's everything. Like, it's ethics, it's like, you know, it's different ethic boards, it's different whole system. It's things that look simple to do, you know, like such OMI, which is a music project, like, which is seems to me that was, oh, that won't be a problem. It's a big problem just between getting ethics approval from education and health. It's like, so, anyways, but.
Did we really study a parallel study on the way in which the ethics, you know, like.
It would be, yeah.
Like
how,
how ethics is getting in the way of being able to do ethically.
Yeah. Ethics on product, right? Yeah, no, that would be interesting. For sure. Yeah.
Any other questions? Any other comments? Yeah, last one.
More of a comment than a question, probably. I'm in social work and I'm doing some research in childhood disability, and we're using more of an umbrella term, to include as many disorders as possible. So we're looking at neurodevelopmental disorders. Mm-hmm. So CP falls under it, and numerous other conditions. And I find it interesting that we're trying to use models that are based on World Health Organization and the ICFCOI, so that we're removing the responsibility and the focus of disability from the individual and the actual condition that they might have, and trying to show how it's more of a social. Yet some of the studies that I'm involved with are really condition specific, and your study is bringing out some really interesting data specific to CP. Mm-hmm. And so when we're looking at working with policy and trying to have a wider lens with which to look at policy so that the most children and families are included as possible, how do we do that when funding agencies tend to fund disability specific studies more easily? Probably because they're easier to, you know, put in a box and explain than a broader content. So again,
this is a very interesting point, one that I've discussed at many times with many different people. And the problem here is, and I've debated that, like, should we go ahead with disability specific? Should we go ahead with just developmental disability or near developmental disability, call it what you want? The thing is, for policy, there's this dual issue, right? If you come with childhood disabilities, then you have a big group, you have a sample that is much bigger, right? So it has a higher impact. You can say, okay, 14% of kids in Canada have disabilities. So that's something. Whereas with CP, if you take, it would be like less than 1% or something like that. So, but on the other hand, when you say, here's a child with CP who has, you know, who can walk, who can go to the school in their neighborhood because they adapted school, they were classified to go as like 25 kilometers away from their home. So you put a face into the problem, and that seems to be one effective communication strategy to address it. which is, you know, attaching stories to data or to, so you, and that's what Alton has done in terms of, that's how Alton has grown, and is one of the only disabilities that have a representation in every provincial policy documents. Everybody knows what Alton means because it's autism. If it was just a generic development disability, what it is, it wouldn't have gone that far, I believe, because, you know, they didn't have advocacy groups, they didn't have media, they didn't have all these other sources of information that come in. Now, the policy dialogue that we're planning to do is something that we want to, it's part of what is in the agenda to be discussed, is what's the best way to frame that, and looking at that, you know. So, which is exactly that, is it better to go by condition, is it better to go by numbers that add up?
Because the needs of kids, obviously there are some needs that are specific to the condition, but usually, in general, the mobility needs are quite similar. So if we, if we try to go towards this number of children in Canada have these types of mobility needs that need to be addressed, as opposed to, well, this is because of CP or this or this, then we have really good numbers to go with too. But it's hard, like, how do you jump out of this and the, to do this?
This is
given that the time frame between studying and getting her evidence out is...
Which is like, you know, it can work the sorry?
No, go ahead. I'm just going to follow up in a minute, but after you had a chance to respond.
No, so it's a matter of, like, the other way around is that, you know, if you start by naming it and framing it and having the story attached to it, and then once you get whatever you get some outcome out of this, then you can say, okay, so this is what we got for CP, but that's what's generic that all children who can't walk could use. Or that's what we got for autism, but that's what we have for autism social behavior issues to use. So that's some kind of the approach that has been successful, which is, for instance, like Australia and UK have done in terms of disability policies for children. They ever, both, all successful stories have started from disability specific, diagnosis specific cases, and build into how this applies to the big picture.
So I was just going to make a comment. Thought about in response to what you were saying. I mean, that perhaps that's why the research and the policy are out of sync, because the research is really needed to get funding, and more and more you have to actually identify a specific disability. Otherwise, and it also wouldn't be serious research if it was very
heterogeneous group.
Whereas the policy has to be, for the as you said, general. Concept of disability much more generally construed.
Right.
So I suppose going back to Daniel's putting those two points together, you know, it's going to be very theoretically difficult to get, I mean, to really integrate research and policy in the way that you're suggesting. I mean, to sort of do them simultaneously, because
And I think the level, again, you know, the level of information that you get out of this long 4-year research study is limited, right, to how much this can inform the big picture and everything that has changed from when you started the project to when you finished. So this is all too part of what I think, like, the only solution would be really have a really integrated approach that your research project needs to evolve with, you know, the policy needs. Otherwise, you just...
Thank you.
Good, thank you.